Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Well, it seemed like this day would never come, but television ads are back to selling beer and hearing aids rather than candidates, and the Congress and state legislatures are mostly set for the next 2 years. Today, I'm rejoined by two guests who have helped parse out election results in the past. Mike Backus is the clerk of Oswego County. He has served on the staff of Republican Congressman John McHugh and State Assemblyman Brian Kolb. He's also a former Oswego County Republican chairman. Chris Farisee is a political science professor at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Prior to becoming an academic, he had experience as field director for Democrat David Fink's congressional run in Michigan. He's also the author of a book titled Welfare for the Wealthy. Well, welcome back to both of you to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So let me start with an overview question, and then we'll dig into some of the details of this. We'll look at the nation, and we also need to look at the state here in New York a little bit. But let me start with this overall question. Chris, I'll start with you. What's the main storyline from the midterm results? Do they tell us anything about the country's political moods or inclinations that we didn't already know?
Yeah, so normally the president's party loses seats in the first midterm, but we had wondered about how much energy there was in a backlash to Trump, and we saw that energy yesterday. So Democrats are on pace right now to pick up 34 to 36 seats in the House. The national vote, if you total all the voters who vote for Democratic versus Republican candidates, looks like that gap is going to be around 9.2 percentage points in favor of Democrats. So there was lots of energy on the Democratic side, and it showed up yesterday in the House results.
And I'll agree with a lot of that. Yeah. Thank you. And I'll agree with a lot of that, that there definitely was a lot of energy on that side of the aisle. However, I think you look at some of the results from Florida especially, and you saw some of the change there, and you saw Republicans still come home at the end of the day and stay on that side of the aisle. I want to agree that, yes, the if you add all the numbers up, yes, that is indeed the number. But I also think that, you know, President Trump was not necessarily on the ballot this year. So I think if you look at some specific congressional races, which I know we'll talk about, there were drop-offs like a midterm always is. So I do think that there's a little bit of a difference there from a projection standpoint. So, yeah, the Democrats obviously had a good night. They took back the House. Didn't get the Senate, so you didn't see that entire blue wave as I think people thought they might see. But there definitely was that change.
Is there anything, Mike, that happened on Tuesday that just really surprised you? You're just like, oh, I didn't see that coming at all.
Absolutely, yeah. I thought you would have seen some of these Senate seats be more competitive. I wasn't surprised by the Texas result. I thought that Senator Cruz would hold that seat.
That seemed to be kind of trending his
absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, O'Rourke there was kind of ill-served by some of the nationalization of that race. I think all the attention kind of came in really early and kind of peaked for him a little in a lot of ways. But to Chris's point, that did help them bring some House seats in Texas into the blue column. So that was something that I think I saw coming. Some of the Florida results I spoke about a second ago, I was surprised at how well Rick Scott did. I thought that would be a much more close race. I thought that the Senate race there would have been closer. But, you know, at the same time, I think that it wasn't quite as a wave as I think people thought it was going to be and was made up by the media.
And, Chris, what surprised you?
So I had thought that out of the three high-profile races, the Democratic or the governor's race in Georgia, the Democratic governor's energy in Florida with all the attention and money put down with Gillum, and the Texas Senate race, that one of those would have flipped. Now, Georgia, they're still in the process of counting ballots.
Might be a runoff.
Yeah, it might be a runoff there. But right now it looks like Kemp, the Republican candidate, is going to win the Georgia governor's race. So I thought that was a little bit surprising. And also there was a little bit higher Republican turnout than I thought. I mean, given, you know, the president's pretty low popularity rating, especially given the economic conditions, you know, there were his base voters who were energized. Throughout the kind of – it met a little bit of the blue wave and, you know, it made it not an historic night but a really good night for Democrats.
Well, maybe, though, historic in a way in that both parties were energized for a midterm. I mean, that's pretty unusual, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's good news for democracy in that you saw a 37% increase in voter turnout compared to the 2014 election, and you saw competitive races, right? So one reason that people give for why they don't vote is that I know how it's going to turn out, so why show up? But there were competitive races across the country last night and in places where you usually don't see competitive races.
Now, Mike, you mentioned a couple different states when you were talking about things that surprised you. A different way to ask about patterns is to think about demographic patterns. So are there any that you and you know, we're still parsing out these results now. We're talking on Thursday, so you know, we'll know more in the next week. But are there any demographic patterns that leaped out at you?
Well, I know we're going to talk about the impact of women here shortly, and this definitely was a women's night in a lot of ways.
Well, we can
a
talk
lot
about that now.
Of people that came out to vote and female candidates. Chris, you have the number. I think that there was a number of candidates actually were elected as female candidates, and I think that was definitively a reaction to some of the policies and some of the statements that President Trump has been making. And I think that's really was one of the mainstays for me was that, and maybe that's part of the why the numbers changed a little bit, was I think women really did show up and voted and said, even though I know necessarily my vote may not change this election, I'm going to make my voice heard no matter what. And I really think that was an important takeaway for me.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, so we have 96 women now projected to be in the House, which would be a record. But the demographic change that I find most interesting is geographic. So the suburbs used to be pretty competitive, and a lot of suburbs lean Republican. And you're seeing a change that started in 2012, continued in 2016, and now really solidified with 2018, where the suburbs where you have more educated voters are really turning blue. And responding to the Trump presidency by moving to the Democratic Party. And then in rural areas that maybe went 60-40 for Republicans are now going 80-20, right? So you have a deepening of Republican identity in rural areas, but now you have suburban areas which are turning more and more blue, and in places you wouldn't expect, right? The Houston suburbs, the Dallas suburbs, like the Atlanta suburbs. So these are areas where Democrats are really gaining a foothold. And, you know, two election cycles ago were pretty competitive.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Professor Chris Farisee and Oswego County Clerk Mike Backus. We're talking about the election results from Tuesday's elections. On that point, Chris, it sounds then that We've been talking a lot in the last couple decades about this issue of political polarization. It sounds like then the electorate last night got further polarized.
It did geographically, right? I mean, it doesn't seem as if the polarization is going to break anytime soon because it would take Republicans reaching out to voters of color and maybe trying to get back people in the suburbs, and Democrats doing more to reach out to people in rural areas. And it seems like they're so fired up by their base right now that it would be difficult for parties to kind of try to balance that by reaching out to the other side.
Go ahead,
I think
Mike.
That's right. Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think it's going to be, you know, with I assume it'll be Speaker Pelosi come January. It's going to be incumbent upon, you know, House Democrats, especially in terms of how they want to construe the message, because I think we've seen sometimes that the overreach sometimes takes a stance, and that's when you lose the middle of the country. That's where you lose some of these districts as you go back towards the general election. And I think that's going to kind of be incumbent on both sides of the aisle. I still see that tribalization of our politics. There's no doubt about it. It's definitely going to be R versus D, red versus blue. And as I think we see in the press conference from yesterday, this president is not going to back down from that. That is just no question about that. And, you know, some other things may affect how he decides to interpret that and how he wants to push policies with the Democrat House now. But, you know, he does have that Republican Senate to fall back on, and that is his big last piece.
So let's take that polarization, and you know, the electorate looks like it became more polarized. Also, if you look at the people who lost and won, the Congress is going to be more polarized, at least as far as I understand. So, thinking about the policy, Chris, and what are going to be what we can likely see in the nation for the next couple of years. I mean, are we now going to be looking at a couple years that are going to be similar to Obama's last 6 years, which is kind of getting little done by design?
Yes. And so you throw in not only divided government, which will create impediments to getting policy passed, but you also have the Democratic-controlled House who's going to conduct oversight into a lot of the abuses and scandals in the Trump administration. And President Trump indicated yesterday that the more oversight that occurs by the House, the less likely he's going to be willing to work with Democrats in the House on pieces of legislation. So you'll have these parallel tracks that will feed into one another. And, you know, once the Mueller report gets released and there's oversight, that is going to create tension that really creates obstacles for getting things done.
Mike, what's your sense of where this is going? I mean, one concern I've heard some analysts voice is that if the Democrats in the House do really aggressively pursue investigations, possibly even impeachment, two things may come out of that. First of all, it may worsen all the problems that people are complaining about if it ultimately doesn't end up in removing the president from office. And secondly, it could set this president up for a reelection that might benefit, campaign that might benefit him.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that you're looking at gridlock. I really believe that. The only thing I would say is that at the end of the day, I do see President Trump as being someone that will be somewhat transactional. And I think that if he is approached by some House leadership with some ideas on infrastructure, I think there are some things that this president does want to get done. I think he does want an immigration deal. I just think some of the things he's going to want in an immigration deal are going to be some things that national Democrats are not going to want to approve heading into a 2020 general election. So I really see a lot of gridlock coming. I don't know if I'll see productivity coming out of Washington, but I do think that there are going to be some opportunities for, Senator Schumer, I think, is somebody that could work with President Trump on certain things if he has the ability from the House to get any of that stuff through Nancy Pelosi.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Oswego County Clerk Mike Backus and political science professor Chris Farisee, and we're discussing the outcomes in this week's midterm elections. Chris, we were talking before about what might happen policy-wise, what the next 2 years might look like in terms of Congress and the president. Mike mentioned that he could see there might be a deal on infrastructure, perhaps immigration. That one's probably a longer reach. But there's one that I thought of that I wanted to get your take on, which was the negotiation of prescription drug prices for Medicare. This has come up perennially. It's never been able to get through. I think Big Pharma has something to do with that. But it is something that the president has expressed interest in the past, and it's something that Democrats have talked about as well. And that could be something, I think, that could be seen as, from the Democratic side, here's something important we've done to, in a sense, expand access to health care and make it more complete. And on the Republican side, they could be talking about saving money and that kind of thing. So I don't know. Do you see that as a possibility?
It is. It's a possibility because Democratic voters expressed health care as their number one issue when they showed up at the midterms, right? So besides just the general anti-Trump sentiment, people are worried about health care costs. And so that could definitely be a space for some policy movement. Also, candidate Trump, when he was running, talked about protecting Medicare and Social Security. So he could be called on, living up to that promise and doing something on Medicare costs. And no one ever lost an election by appealing to elderly voters.
So, go ahead,
if
Mike.
I could, I really think that that's a great issue for President Trump. And, I'm the chair of a federally qualified healthcare center based in Pulaski, New York, ConnectsCare. And, we service low-income folks, single moms, folks that need healthcare in rural communities. And Congresswoman Elise Stefanik is one of the bipartisan co-chairs of a caucus in Congress, and I know she's a fighter on this issue. And in any investment, whether it's solving prescription drug issues or bringing more money to rural healthcare, will be very, very good to President Trump's base. And I really think that's an issue that both houses of Congress, regardless of your political makeup, can tackle this year. That's a big issue that I think could be solved.
So that's policy. Now let me talk about strategy, party strategy, okay? What, Mike, do you think are the two parties' best strategic approaches to take in the next 2 years? Are there any shared incentives? What if you are advising each of them, what are you telling them to do?
It's going to be really a challenge for the Senate in particular. Now with I've been watching closely what Senator Romney now from Utah has been saying kind of via Twitter and some of the stuff he's already said on the Mueller probe after Jeff Sessions was fired or resigned, depending on your viewpoint, I think, yesterday.
He was fired.
He was, yeah, I think that's probably where most folks are going to head. But it's going to be very interesting to see how Senate Republicans interpret what action is taken by the Pelosi House now and how President Trump reacts to that. President Trump at his rallies is one person. President Trump in Washington in the White House is another. It's going to be very interesting to see how Senate Republicans decide to say, okay, what do we want to get done? 2020 is going to be a very different year for the United States Senate in terms of seats that are going to be opening up with President Trump than 2018 was this year. It'll be more Republicans we have to fight for. So I think that that's going to be a very interesting time from a political strategy to say, all right, what can we actually tackle? That's why I highlight immigration. I do think that there is a deal that could be made there with the House to try to solve some of that, and definitely infrastructure. This president likes to build things, do things that he can be productive on. I think the Senate could push those issues.
So it sounds like, though, you think the best strategic move for Republicans is to try to accomplish things rather than to just accept the gridlock.
Voters like the tax cut. There was something there that really was a good thing for our base. And I think that if they focus on those things and say, all right, we checked these boxes. This is a president that likes to say, I did this. Those are important things, and I think if they focus on that, they'll be able to have some successes. It's just what also will come out of the House. That's going to be the interesting part.
What's your sense, Chris?
And one area I disagree with, so I think there's movement on infrastructure. I think there's movement on health care. I don't see a way forward with immigration given the White House's use of immigration as a way to demonize. So, by the way, there's been no stories about the caravan for 2 days, right? Yeah. So it was obvious that was a political ploy, right, to scare people into coming out and voting on Tuesday. So, and there was what political observers see as potentially one of the most racist political ads in recent history that President Trump tweeted out about immigration. So given the demonization of immigrants by this administration, I see it as a really hard lift for Democrats to come to the table and work with the president on immigration because of how he has used this issue as a cudgel to demonize immigrants and brown people.
So if you are giving strategy advice then to the Democrats here in the next 2 years in Congress, what are you telling them? Press the attack or look for things that can get done?
I would say there's no choice. You could do both. I mean, okay. One is that people want checks and balances. The Republican Party in Congress abdicated their role of oversight and checking the powers and abuses of the White House. So people want someone to investigate and to oversee some of the abuses that have gone in the White House. But also people want something to get done. So you have to do both. It's going to be a hard tightrope to walk, but it's one that House Democrats have to do if they want to show people that they deserve the White House and the Senate in 2020.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guests are Chris Farrisee and Mike Backus. I do want to have some time to talk about the state here in New York and what those elections mean, particularly the state Senate. But let me squeeze this one last question in about the national scene, and then we'll shift to that. So if you could be brief on this one. But do you see anything in the election results and the midterms that will tell us anything about how you think the presidential race is going to shape up? And in particular, maybe what would happen on the Democratic side. So, Chris, I'll start with you on this. But any clues about what we're likely to see emerge in terms of candidates there?
Well, as far as candidates, I think two people who are not getting enough attention are Sherrod Brown, who won re-election in Ohio when Ohio elected a Republican as governor, and Amy Klobuchar, who has the largest approval rating and also the largest margin of victory of any of the Senate candidates. So those are two moderate to progressive candidates who have cachet with the working class, are from the Midwest. So I think that's a potential. But as far as this predicting 2020, I really don't see that happen. I mean, think about what happened in 2010, right? Republicans won a humongous victory in 2010, and then Obama won a steady victory over Romney in 2012, right? So 2 years is a lifetime in politics. So besides those being potential candidates, I mean, the biggest effect is going to be the change to the election laws, right? So Florida passed Amendment 4, which adds 1.4 million ex-felons to the rolls. Michigan and Maryland made it easier to vote. So those are going to have a larger impact on 2020 than anything as far as the voting trends.
I agree 100% with everything he just said on this. And it's 2 years is – we have about 15 media cycles, I think, within a day now. It really is that extreme. And I just don't – I think, Chris, you and I are going to be back here doing the show every week if we wanted to, and it would be a different – conversation on what does 2020 present, and I'd be willing to do that, by the way.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
It'd be very different to see
I
how
think the people want it.
That's right, the people want it. Absolutely. Okay. They're demanding it, really. We really, the presidential makeup of 2020 is going to be very, very different, and it really, I think it's going to be told in the first 6 months of Washington here shortly in terms of how the House goes about its investigations. Does Mueller come forward with a report or a probe? Does the president try to affect that? All of that, I think, is going to be told in the first 6 months, and we're going to know very quickly what both sides kind of look like as you develop your field, because I think that field is continually going to expand.
So stick with you, Mike, and now we're going to turn our attention to New York State. So looking at the New York State results, any election results there that really leapt out at you, any that surprised you?
I was not surprised by Congressman Katko's result. I felt like he was going to be able to weather what would be a significant turnout in Onondaga County with the offset of the rural counties, including Oswego. I was surprised Chris Collins won. I did not think that district, even as red as it is, would stay held in Republican hands. Congressman Reed had a tougher challenge than I thought he would, but he got through the finish line as well. Nothing that really jumped out too much. You know, I don't know. We know a result yet in NY22. I thought that was a very early call from ABC News. There, I think the paper is going to come down to seeing
that's
whether or not Brindisi and Tenney win.
District, yeah.
That's right. I think, you know, obviously Anthony Brindisi is ahead at the moment, but there's still a lot of absentees and day of vet ballots that are out there. So I'm not surprised by any of that necessarily. I thought that the governor's numbers were very, very strong. That's the domination of Democrats in New York State at the state level really was shown on Tuesday. There's no doubt about that.
Well, the state Senate now has changed. Two things have happened, I think, to the state Senate. One is it is now going to be in Democratic control. The other thing is the center of weight in the Democratic caucus has, I think, moved to the left, and that is in large part because of that handful of Democratic challengers and Democratic primaries to the members of the IDC who won, challenged them from the left. Now they're in office. Chris, looking at that, what do you think might happen at the state level? What can we expect here in the next year or two to come out of this? I think it puts the governor in an interesting situation, among other things.
Yeah, no, he now has to be more responsible to the progressives in his own party who have been critical of him over the past 4 years. So I think you might see some voting and election changes similar to what we saw in Michigan be pressed by people in New York State. So there were lots of complaints coming out of New York City about long lines and just how inefficient it is in New York State to vote. So I think that might be an issue that gets pressed.
I think too that the governor's going to be hard pressed with some of the issues coming out of the progressive caucus now. I look at Rachel May, you know, stepping in now for Dave Valesky here in Central New York. Dave Valesky, very much a middle of the road legislator, could work with both sides of the aisle. Had truly an upstate focus and a broad based upstate focus. He had just as many, I think, Republican supporters as he did Democrat. Oftentimes, you know, I don't necessarily see that now in Rachel coming in, and she's going to have a different component, a different aspect to look at, and she's going to push issues like the New York State Reproductive Health Initiative and some of those issues. And I'm not sure necessarily where the governor is going to stand on some of those things. So the Democrat caucus within the Senate is going to be very interesting to see how they make up the group. The thing is, now with so many members, they can let a few off the hook if they need to. And that's going to be a really, really different change for New York State voters.
So you mentioned Rachel May and Dave Valesky. I want to use that as the segue into this question about what might be going on in the next couple of years. To me, I think the single biggest thing that's going to come up as an issue is the Health Act. Mm-hmm. Which basically establishes a single-payer system for the citizens in the state of New York, funded by tax dollars. And Rachel May's criticism of Dave Valesky on this program, as a matter of fact, was that Dave Valesky is in support of it in terms of saying, I'm in favor of it, but he wasn't really working in the trenches to make it happen. And that's where she criticized him, and that's what she said she was going to do differently. Now, this is a huge thing for the state. I mean, we're not talking about a small policy change here. And, Chris, you study these kinds of policies. Tell me how you see that playing out, because I think this, the support for this, my take on this, is the support for this in the past, and oftentimes by Democrats, has been somewhat symbolic, because they know it's not going to come into fruition. It's not going to happen with the Republican Senate. Now this thing is real, and it got real, real fast. So how is this going to play out?
Well, I think it'll be popular initially. I mean, you know, the idea like Medicare for All has gotten more energy, but once the price tag gets revealed and once there's a discussion of the cost that would come about in bringing this type of program, I think is that where you might see, start to see more divisions within the party.
Do you see this actually happening? Personally, it's hard for me to see this actually happening.
I think it has a potential. I mean, people really care about health care. And I've gone out to counties outside of Onondaga to speak about healthcare after 2016, and there's a lot of energy around that issue. So it might.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for this part of the conversation. There's more to talk about, and we will do that online. But for now, that was Mike Backus and Chris Farisee. I want to thank both of you for making the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest. And for more of this conversation, please go to WRVO.org.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.